Is at this time. It's the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host Don Olson and Dave Gudnick, and we'll be talking about some of the affairs of the day and why it's so important to keep on doing that. We're going to start off with another Pascal Nattes. He'll be talking about peace through weakness, the real Tomahawk story is worse than you think. He's on neutrality studies, and he a professor at Kyoto University in Japan. And after that, I'll bring up things about Trump's recent agreement with Australia about rare minerals. But listening to Pascal Nattes, you get an idea. Well, what it gives me a better idea of what are these rare earth minerals and how do they come into being. So this was posted 2 days ago, on Tuesday.
It's just the latest version, again, of other such stories, right, of escalation over escalation. In the Ukraine proxy war. And that this, that what we have seen time and again is that these escalationary steps were taken, be it by the, especially by the Biden. Have decided, apparently, at least for now, to not provide Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. And when I say provide Tomahawk missiles, what I mean is that they decided against firing Tomahawk missiles into 22 Russia.
I thought I had a cue up right. It was kind of a tricky thing, but we'll get to it.
Let's try it.
Okay, here we go.
So, the United States has decided, apparently, at least for now, to not provide Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. And when I say provide Tomahawk missiles, what I mean is that they decided against firing Tomahawk missiles into pre-2022 Russia. Because by now it also has circulated enough in the media that the United States was actually thinking about using their own contractors, not even pretending anymore that they were trading Ukrainians on these systems, but just they said outright that it would be U.S. contractors going to Ukraine with these weapons and then from unknown locations, then firing those long-range missiles into Russia as a way to pressure Russia into peace negotiations. But really what this was is the U.S. Toying with the idea of using now an even higher and more potent weapon category directly by themselves, using Ukraine as has happened over the last 2.5 years, as the excuse to directly attack Russia, right? We know also the HIMARS and so on, they were operated by Americans. The data gathering, the intelligence, the satellite imagery, the guidance system and so on, and even the targeting system and targeting decisions were done in Wiesbaden, Germany by the NATO and US command. Two New York Times articles said so much, and what we are talking about here then is exactly the same thing, just with a higher weapons category. Now, in the media, this was spun, of course, from the pro-Ukrainian side as a way of the United States supporting poor victim Ukraine. But in the blogosphere, it has been well understood that this is just the latest version of a really, really dangerous escalation, because the Tomahawk missiles are, of course, capable of carrying nuclear warheads. And this is one of the largest taboos ever that the superpowers would target each other with nuclear-capable missiles. So overall, this was, of course, a very large escalation. And the way that now the narrative is presented to us by articles like this one in CNN, CNN is that Donald Trump somehow decided not to escalate, that Donald Trump decided that it would be one step too far and it would be too dangerous. But I would like to draw your attention to another aspect of this, which I think is the true reason why this decision was taken. It's not that the United States wouldn't want to escalate and the Trump administration is afraid to escalate. I believe, based upon what has happened over the past couple of weeks, and actually the past couple of years, that we have reached a point in which the administration, or at least one part of the administration, had to come to terms with a very new fact, which is that their stockpile and their weapons manufacturing capacities are not unlimited, and that they are now running low. So we have other articles, and I would like to just point to this one here from the New York Times, when Trump was actually thinking about providing missiles, this back and forth that we've gone through over the last 3 weeks, the Tomahawk missile story, which actually is just the latest version, again, of other such stories, right, of escalation over escalation in the Ukraine proxy war. And that this, that what we have seen time and again is that these escalationary steps were taken, be it by the, especially by the Biden administration, but also Donald Trump has this history of trying to tough talk on one day and then on the other day say like, no, I want to stop the bloodshed. Now, We will see. I will show you the reasons why I say that it's not the de-escalation factor, but that it is actually a military production factor that informs his decisions. I would just like to show you one of several comments Donald Trump made over the last 1 week, where he cast serious doubt on whether Tomahawks will be provided. At least for now, the decision seems to be a no. And again, by provided, I shouldn't use that jargon. I should say, like, fire Tomahawks into Russia. Trump said no firing of Tomahawks into Russia. And look at this exchange here. This is the visit of Mr. Zelensky at the White House 2-3 days ago, on Friday last week, and the press conference. And just listen to Mr. Trump's framing of the situation, of the predicament the United States is in when it comes to these weapons, to the Tomahawk systems.
What's going to happen if the United States is in a conflict and we need the Tomahawk?
That's the problem. We need Tomahawks, and we need a lot of other things that we've been sending over the last 4 years to Ukraine. We've been, you know, we gave them a lot. Now we have a different situation. We send it to the European Union. They pay for it and all that, and they have plenty of money. But it's beyond the money. You know, we need Tomahawks, and we need a lot of other weapons that we're sending to Ukraine. One of the reasons we want to get this war over is exactly that. It's not easy for us to give. You're talking about massive numbers of very powerful weapons. So that's one of the things we'll be talking about. Hopefully they won't need it. Hopefully we'll be able to get the war over with without thinking about Tomahawks.
So you see how Donald Trump keeps like flip-flopping from the position of, well, we have all we need, we can win this war, the Ukraine can win this war. And of course, he said very famously a couple of weeks ago in this very ironic, almost cynical post, that the Ukraine can obviously win and can even win back all of the territories that it lost in 2014, including Crimea. But while we know now that probably this wasn't meant serious, we constantly need to wonder how the United States assesses its own capabilities. And you know, the neocons are notorious for not giving a damn about reality and just assuming unlimited capacity, unlimited capability, and hence pushing for unlimited escalation. But we know that there are other wings inside the U.S. administration, especially the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, Department of War, and the intelligence community, which do, as part of their jobs, try to keep track of real-world affairs constraints and real world assessments of situations on the ground. And it seems to me that by now Mr. Trump, much more than by a conversation with Mr. Putin on the phone, was actually convinced in the background, hearing this, that, well, we actually got a problem. We got a weapons problem. We have a production problem. And I would like to show you this now. I think it's not a coincidence that this turnaround on the Tomahawk story is coming about 10 days after China announces rare earth curbs on basically anyone in the world, but especially on US on US weapons manufacturers. So I talked about this in another video a week ago, that this is one of the biggest power moves of China so far, in which, just very briefly, they now said that they are going to use what is called the foreign direct product rule for their rare earths, saying that they will require any company that wants to buy rare earth products from them needs to certify that these rare earth products will not be used in for weapons manufacturing. That is weapons manufacturing anywhere, but especially, of course, also in the United States. So, and these rare earth minerals are extremely, extremely important. Let me read you from this article here by the CSIS, a U.S. think tank that actually summarizes this very well, what that means, just very briefly, so that we're up to speed. Rare earths are crucial for various defense technologies, including F-35 fighter jets, Virginia and Columbia-class submarines, Tomahawk missiles, radar systems, Predator unarmed aerial vehicles, and the Joint Direct Attack Munitions series of smart bombs. The newly announced restrictions represent China's most consequential measures to date targeting the defense sector. Under the new rules, starting on December 1st, 2025, companies with any affiliation to foreign militaries, including those of the United States, will be largely denied export licenses. The Ministry of Commerce also made clear that any requests to use rare earths for military purposes will be automatically rejected. Even before these latest measures, the US defense industrial base faced significant challenges and had limited production capacity and limited ability to rapidly scale to meet rising defense technology needs. The new restrictions will only deepen these vulnerabilities. Now, this is a real problem, and to me, to my mind, is now what is winning out in Washington. The realism is setting in that the capacity of the United States, the sheer weapons manufacturing capacity, might be a problem. And, you know, we have two aspects to this, right? On the one hand, we have the stockpile. We have the weapons that have already been produced and that are just around in case or ready for export. On the other hand, we have the ability to reproduce these weapons. And for the longest time, for the last 50, 60 years, it looked as if the United States, if it decides to produce weapons, it can basically do so at more or less any scale it wants. Just a question of how much time it will take until these weapons are produced. Hence, any kind of war in the world can be fought basically at will. But it now looks as if though this game has seriously changed. And this is the point where I would like to alert you to a wonderful article by a regular guest on this podcast here on Neutrality Studies, Arnaud Bertrand, the French analyst residing previously residing in China, now in Southeast Asia. How long can he has a wonderful Substack. Arnaud Bertrand has a great Substack, and I encourage all of you to subscribe to him because he provides really high class information analysis time and time again. He wrote recently this very long piece, "How long can China play the rare earths card?" And in this article, he takes the example of gallium, the one of these now restricted rare earths. Although I understand that gallium itself is not on the periodic table, is a little bit different. But anyhow, it's one of these metals that is going to be under restriction under export licensing. And the problem with that one, and we need to understand why these rare earths are not only important for US manufacturing, but why it's not easy to suddenly get them from somewhere else than China. Because another article really summarized it very well, because rare earths is kind of a bad naming convention for these metals, because this article here puts it very, very nicely. They would better be named as troublesome earths. The problem is not that you don't have many of them in the crust of the earth. There's plenty of it. But in order to extract them, the extraction process is really, really tough. And Arnaud Bertrand does a wonderful job at like showing the rat's tail, or all of the little steps that this requires in order to extract them. Because like on the face of it, you would think that okay, it's a rare earth, right? You find a deposit, a gallium deposit, then you take some backhoe and a couple of drillers, you take out the stones, and then a little bit of heat, and then gallium flows out. Well, turns out that's not how it works, that's not how it works with most of these troublesome earths. What you have to do, and there's a very pretty paper here that describes this, is that most of these rare earths are actually byproducts of the extraction of other more common metals. And the example of gallium is that in order to produce gallium, you must, at least for large-scale production, you must produce aluminium.
So that was Pascal Natsos talking about PC weakness, the real Tomahawk story on his neutrality studies. Now, on Tuesday, when that story was presented, there was a big to-do about how Trump turns to Australia they've signed a critical minerals deal at the White House on Monday. Well, as the U.S. eyes the continent's rich rare earth resources when China is imposing toughing rules on exporting its own critical minerals abroad. And the two leaders described the agreement as a $8.5 billion deal between the allies. And the agreement could have an immediate impact on rare earth supplies in the U.S. if American companies can secure some of what Australian mines are already producing, although it will take years, if not decades, to develop enough of a supply of rare earths outside of China to reduce their dominance. Penny Altos, who founded U.S. Rare Earth back in 2019, cautioned that Australia can't supply everything the U.S. needs, so it is crucial that the U.S. continues to invest in long-term efforts to develop other mining and processing projects, both at home and in friendly nations. Keep in mind, he says, China has almost a 40-year head start on us. We have at least a couple of decades to catch up to China in terms of being able to meet our own supply chain processes. Well, Dave Gunick, you have some comments, I bet.
Well, that was certainly a stark conclusion, which shows you've got to read beyond the headlines. The headlines say, hey, look over here, we got a new thing going. Look over there, there's new sanctions. Look over here, we got a new weapons. But the full story is that we are going to have to admit limits, which we hate doing. United States refuses to recognize limits, resource or financial limits. Instead, we just generate more debt. And the weapons system is something we are unused to seeing or hearing about, and Pascal has done a good introduction to why it's complicated to simply generate these critical minerals. Again, they have many hundreds of uses, both military and non-military, and we are facing, in fact, our whole experimental civilization, if you want to take it that far, are facing real limits. And we've posited our whole adventure and our policy, our ideology, and our economy on growth and more growth, and especially with regard to weaponry, of course, which is our absolute single biggest industry. And again, we are encountering limits which we are unfamiliar with. And China has played the critical minerals card, as the one writer mentioned, because they feel they are in a commanding position. By the way, that one reference was to, just so those who want to look it up, the blogger's name was Arnaud, A-R-N-A-U-D, Bertrand, B-E-R-T-R-A-N-D, who goes into greater depth about the limitations and the requirements for this kind of critical minerals production. So we're facing a real bind here. That's the number one lesson there. And I want to mention also that Pascal makes clear, which people should know, but they don't because they just read the headlines, that the U.S. has had a pretense for quite some time of assisting Ukraine in this war. And yet, in fact, at least since 2014, in my view, and explicitly, according to the New York Times in March of last year, controlled all aspects, military intelligence, planning, targeting, financial, and so on. It's been a U.S. war, not an assistant, but the U.S.-directed war against Russia on the plains of Ukraine. So just remember, whenever they talk about Russia and Ukraine at war, it's really the U.S. and Russia fighting in Ukraine.
Yes, that is quite a bit. And just for context, with us speaking about U.S. Military-industrial production, the U.S. by far is the world's biggest purveyor of weapons. And in fact, the U.S. is larger than the next nine countries in combined
expenditures.
That's for China, includes China and Russia and NATO countries. So the U.S. has all this, but what's it going to? Some of these weapon systems that are very highly expensive, highly developed, and it's not always what's in there, but be that as it may.
So I want to give a couple of other important pieces to the scenario there that precede this recognition of the critical minerals crisis, which China has now absolutely brought to the fore. And one is the history of Ukraine counteroffensives, which is again used via headlines to keep up public support. Just one more battle, Ukraine's winning, Russia's losing, and giving you exciting headlines. But here's a brief history of the counteroffensives. The hugest, biggest one launched by Ukraine was in October 2022, 6 months or so after the start of the current phase of the war. Then there was another one in summer's 2023, after huge losses eventually by Ukraine. They brought in lots of new brigades and some reconstituted forces. Did not do real well in that offensive. Then in 2024, they had a very daring offensive invasion of Kursk into Russian territory, which took several months after many, many thousands of Ukrainian losses before they were evicted from there. But here's the pattern. The offensives were demanded by Kiev and Russian backers, but each one was smaller and weaker than the previous one. And now NATO and Ukraine have exhausted supplies of manpower and weapons. And so the critical mineral thing, again, is bringing to the fore that we have real limits on what we can produce as well as what we have by way of weaponry. So that's number one. The history of the counteroffensives is not encouraging for Ukraine. Secondly, there's a history of U.S. Weapons escalation. Again, with the headlines saying just you know, the latest wonder weapon will turn the tide, and this will be the Abrams tanks, it'll be the Storm Shadow missiles, it'll be the TACMs, it'll be the HIMARS, and now it'll be the Tomahawks. Just hang on, this latest thing will turn the tide in Ukraine's favor. But the reality is, which is seeping in even to the mainstream, is that Ukraine is losing and might be on the brink of a disastrous loss and end to the war. Secondly, I want to mention the history of sanctions, which is sort of like the definition of insanity. You keep doing the same thing, even though it fails, and expect something different, like banging your head against the wall, expect something different. And Europe has just approved the 19th package of sanctions, which have proven to fail over and over, sanctions on Russia. And it reminds me of the 1960s Rolling Stones song, "It's Just Your 19th Nervous Breakdown." And the meter fits well if you say, "It's Just Your 19th Sanctions Breakdown."
Yes, it goes on and on, and things kind of wiggle and wobble as Trump wiggles and wobbles on his ideas. And it's very important. One reason we concentrated on this show, because virtually all of the mainstream media, both our public and corporate, promotes the basic story that it all began in February of 2022 when Russia went into. But we've gone into some of the history. Maybe we'll go into some of that today about why Russia went in there. But why it's important is because now they're talking about more and more trying to do things against Russia, escalating. And it was interesting that on yesterday's paper, there was a talking about about the Putin-Trump summit abruptly postponed. And I know Davey has some things to say more about it, but it was in the Washington Post article that the U.S. Secretary of State Rubio was to meet with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov to lay the groundwork for a summit with Putin. But the two diplomats appeared to get little further than a phone call. And Russia, on Tuesday, rejected Trump's call to freeze the fighting in Ukraine on the front line, signaling that the Kremlin has not significantly changed his demands. Lavrov said Trump's demand for an immediate ceasefire, which has suddenly become a topic of discussion again, was contrary to what was agreed at the Trump-Putin summit in Alaska in August. So Lavrov went in on to say in this article, if you just stop in the Ukraine, you forget the root causes of this conflict, which the American administration clearly understood. Lavrov said, "I am referring to ensuring Ukraine's non-aligned, non-nuclear status, which implies refraining from any attempts to draw it into NATO." And he added that freezing the fighting now would mean only one thing: a large part of the Ukraine would remain under Nazi rule, referring to leadership in Kiev.
So this kind of escalation, military and otherwise, by the West backing the Kiev regime has happened before, after 2014 and after 2022 in the Minsk agreements. Later admitted that the whole following period, admitted by signatories, Angela Merkel from Germany and François Hollande from France, signatories to the Minsk agreements, admitted that they only used that period to rearm Ukraine and prepare for war. So that's a very vivid memory, but quite recent, about how the ceasefire was used to undermine peace or the possibility for peace. And now the same thing is being proposed by Trump, even though after Alaska, when he actually listened, apparently, to Putin, and realized that ceasefire in isolation was not going to work, because Russia's been saying over and over and over that we have to discuss the root causes of the war. And to put it simply, the root cause of the war is the failure, the refusal of the U.S. and the West to recognize Russian security interests. We don't recognize them. We don't believe we need to recognize them. And so, hence, there's this endless war.
And this, the trick is to keep blaming Russia for doing it. And if you drive it home, and there's kind of the echo chamber of much of the corporate and public media, then it's the U.S. can basically get around whatever it wants, and to keep the goal of weakening Russia. And the in today's paper, Associated Press article, Treasury Secretary of the U.S. Scott Bessent said the new sanctions that they had just put on Russia, on their two largest oil industry corporations, was in direct response to Moscow's refusal to end its senseless war, an attempt to choke off the Kremlin's war machine.
So again, let's try sanctions for the 19th time. Let's try a new weapon system for the 10th time. Medvedev, who's the head of the Russian Industrial Military Commission, very high up, former president, interrupting Putin terms, and is a very militant voice, pro-Russian, in favor of, the Ukraine war campaign. He says this was the last straw when Trump backed off his understanding, as stated after the Alaska conversation, which was quite brief, that simple ceasefire would never work. He said that, admitted it, recognized it, but now, of course, he's reversed that. So Medvedev, who's a very important voice from Russia, says this is the last straw, and it proves that the U.S. and the West are completely unreliable when it comes to negotiations, and the only way to end the war is to crush Ukraine, which militarily that is, and that may be what is unfolding.
These things keep building, and when the rhetoric keeps getting more and more, one never knows what it's going to be. And also in today's paper, talking about how Russia is responding to the added pressures, they said, meanwhile, in what appears to be a public reminder of Russian atomic arsenals, Putin on yesterday, directed drills of the country's strategic nuclear forces. So these things can be lead to one thing to another, and it's U.S. keeps promoting it, but the whole idea, of course, is to make it look like it's the Russians which are postponing it.
Then Europeans are at least as obdurate as the U.S., and so that leads to an interesting situation where they're sometimes blamed by the U.S. for not allowing negotiations or some movement toward peace to happen when, of course, we're still in charge. And the Russians themselves had tried this out in hopes of encouraging Trump and his team, but it's not really working, but Europe is definitely an obstacle to any progress on Ukraine. I believe they're in panic over the diminishing or the threat of diminishing U.S. support for the war and in through NATO in general. But so they're currently making promises they can never fulfill. Their economies are in terrible shape, and the cost of the current cost of the Ukraine war for Europe is $50 billion at a minimum. This is while their economies, again, are suffering badly in Germany, in France, chaos, in England, Britain, going down. So it's very expensive, but they're, again, living on promises and the desire to maintain their vassal relationship with the U.S. military and its plans.
And even to draw some of this topic of what we've been covering today, in the Tuesday's business pages here of the Minnesota Star Tribune, they mentioned that Cleveland Cliffs, the largest player in mining on Minnesota's Iron Range, is exploring whether the company should shift the focus of one of its mines in Minnesota from taconite to rare earth minerals. Well, it's a, I don't know, one time I caught a little bit of a story that rare earth minerals is very it has a lot of environmental consequences. And that there was actually an agreement sometime in the past that, well, U.S. said, we'll let China do that. Let them do the, and so they've been doing it for quite a while and built up quite an expertise in this. So this may also come here to northern Minnesota.
I want to mention one thing so people understand. The very important issue of secondary sanctions has been introduced both by the U.S. and its war on Russia. And the latest, which was mentioned, sanctioning specific state-directed Russian oil companies is also directed at India. This is a secondary part of the sanctions because India buys a huge amount of Russian oil and has stated that it's going to continue doing so, even though, again, the headlines sometimes lead you in a different direction. So, secondary sanctions is also what's now coming into play in what China has said. And these can have enormous economic consequences around the world because secondary sanctions, just to make sure people understand, it means that companies and countries that deal with the sanctioned company or country, that is Russia or a Russian company, are themselves subject to sanctions by the U.S., which, of course, is flaunting its economic power, but losing a lot of friends in the process.
So it's pretty well covering that quite a bit. Well, we have Dave Logsdon has showed up. He's been a longtime contributor to this program, and Dave is the president of the local Vets for Peace Chapter 27. And he has a few things he would like you to know about.
Yeah, Don, and thank you for letting me come on and on the voice of the people here in Fresh Air Radio. And I always tell people, remember now, it isn't Pledge Week, but you can still contribute, and we got to keep this voice alive and well. So yes, cutting to the chase. There's a this movie called The Doctrine that was is concerning the Doctrine of Discovery, and more specifically, these teenage youth that indigenous youth that were mentored in St. Paul by Mitch Walkinook to learn their culture and their language. And during the John Turdell documentary, he got up and said he wants to send these kids to the Vatican to talk to the High Vatican Council about the Doctrine of Discovery and to demand that it be finally abolished from the books in the Vatican. So, long story short, we got involved. We got to help do a benefit at the Universalist Church in Minneapolis, Unitarians, and we raised a whole bunch of money, got them to go, and there was a filmmaker there that was filming the whole process, filming the concert, filming the their trip to the Vatican, and she did, and she got great footage of them talking to the High Vatican Council, and then she went to New Zealand. She's been in the highlands of Central America, talking to indigenous leaders about how the Doctrine of Discovery has affected them and is still affecting them today. So the movie is very, very powerful. It'll be, they sold out the Friday movie at the Twin Cities Film Festival, which is going on right now. But they called and said, hey, can we get another screening? I said, absolutely, we can do that. And so Gwendolyn Cates, the filmmaker who's coming to town today, she agreed, yeah, let's do that. So it's Saturday at the Marcus Theaters in the West End, which is on the, ironically, the West End of the metro area off of Highway 100 and 394 right there. And they have plenty of parking. There's plenty of dining options there, too. So the movie will be shown at 6:30. You can get tickets, and I recommend you go online and get tickets because the movie's got quite a buzz now in the film festival. So if you go to the Twin Cities Film Festival website, you'll have information on how to order tickets for the 6:30 screening. So, but get on it because it definitely will be a sellout. And I have one other thing to talk about.
Before we go to another thing,
yeah,
let's talk about the Doctrine of Discovery. I'm sure there's a lot of people want to know, well, what is that?
Well, if you see the movie, you'll find out.
Yes, but what
if you if you can't go see the movie, Doctrine of Discovery, basically, and there's always nuance to these things. But when Columbus came to the New World, the islands, he didn't come to America. He came to the New World, and he landed on this island. He went back and he said, you know what? There's a lot of good stuff here. We can all make some money, but he said there's one problem. There's people living there, and what do we do about them? You know, we just can't just move in there and take over. So they got on the cell phone to the Vatican, and they said, "Yo, Pope? We need some help here. We need some justification to do this." So the Pope did the papal bull, and the papal bull said, they're infidels. They don't believe in Christ. And if they don't convert to Christianity, they're infidels and savages. And you have every right to, you're the chosen people, so you have every right to take their land and whatever it takes to do it. And they did. They raped and pillaged.
And this is our living legacy because it's still active in Gans in U.S. law.
Yeah, yeah.
In 2005, Ruth Bader Ginsburg,
yep,
writing up a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, cited the Doctrine of Discovery. And the other thing which the Pope did was he drew a line down through the Western Hemisphere. On this half, it's going to be Spanish, would have the first, would be in control. And the other half would be Portuguese. And so that's...
Yeah.
So that's why Brazil has a Portuguese language.
Yeah, and basically, I think he eliminated, he exterminated that population of that tribe, the Arawaki tribe, I think it is. It was really brutal. It was brutal the way he did it. In fact, Columbus wrote in his diary, if you can believe this. This is somebody we have Columbus Day honoring. He wrote in his diary, he said, they're a very kind and peaceful people. This should be very easy to conquer them.
And what was your second, I think?
The second thing was, I've been asked by the WAM, Women Against Military Madness's SCOTA committee that is about concerned with South American problems and issues. And once again, the issue at the UN was coming up to end the blockade on Cuba. And once again, predictably, the United States will be the only two nations, the only two nations in the UN who, you'll never guess who the other one is, that are voting no to ending the blockade in Cuba. And on the Lake Street Bridge next Wednesday at 4 o'clock, Lake Street Marshall Bridge, I should say, in deference to our St. Paul people, the Lake Street Marshall Bridge at 4 o'clock, there'll be a special demonstration about hands off Venezuela and the blockade in Cuba and our interdiction. And now I might as well say hands off Colombia. My God, the beat goes on. Anyway, that's all I got. 4 o'clock on Wednesday at Lake Street Bridge.
Thank you, Dave Logsdon from Vets for Peace. Dave, have you thought anything more we want to talk about for the on the Ukraine or that? Or should I go to my next?
I might have one or two brief things here. I referred briefly earlier to Europe and its obstruction of any moves toward peace and its leadership, that is, just the leadership of Europe is mad with war and make-believe threats from Russia, in my opinion. And they are looking at the latest tactic of using $200 or $300 billion in stolen Russian assets to give more money to Ukraine. So this is just their latest risk-taking stance, which I believe is going to blow back enormously. And already the authorities in Euroclear are warning against this because it's going to undermine faith in investment in the euro and other transactions through Euroclear. So they're, again, shooting themselves in the foot. And just one final thing, I think, remember that the U.S. war is the agenda, and the stance is still to refuse acknowledgement of Russian security interest.
And this has been a long-term project of the United States since the 1990s, since they promised Gorbachev that they would not be, when the okay was given to reunite East and West Germany, that NATO would not move one step to the east. And Bill Clinton then subsequently came to power as a presidency, and in the second half of it, the second of his two presidential terms, Madeleine Albright, as Secretary of State, facilitated bringing in the first three of 15 these countries, Poland, Romania, and Czech Republic.
So actually, fierce arguments extending the expansion of NATO to Ukraine have taken place since the 1990s. Our foremost diplomat, George Kennan, said this whole direction strategy was a fatal mistake on the part of the West and the U.S., whereas the chief war analyst and warmonger, Zbigniew Brzezinski, in his 1970s book, said the Ukraine was the ultimate prize for expansion of NATO. This was warned against by top diplomats, scholars, military people, saying it would result in civil war in Ukraine and would draw Russian intervention. And this is exactly what happened. And I think it was because they decided they wanted this to happen. Remember, even Obama, who's complicit in all this. In 2014, after the coup, said, the last thing we want to do is encourage Ukraine to think that they can prevail against Russia, because Russia would have and does have escalatory dominance in population, in weaponry, in logistics, and so on. So there you have it. 2014, it was clear what the direction of thing was, and it was actually warned against by William Burns, then ambassador to Russia and now CIA director, in a email only released because of WikiLeaks, thank you very much, in which he, in great detail, and this can be found online, warned against trying to get Ukraine in NATO because it would lead, as I just said, to civil war and Russian intervention, which is what happened. So this has been planned and provoked for years.
And it's been a gradual thing. And so in the 90s, Russia was, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, was on its back. And all these Western capitalists were in there trying to pick it clean what was going on. Putin came to power in the, around 2000, 2001. And he would have warned these countries, don't keep doing this.
But our people are still in the 1990s, a heady era of complete supremacy, and think that they can still retain that.
And 2007, it warned against bringing in the country of Georgia as well as the Ukraine, although that was given the go-ahead. It would try and do that. And so it's been a long-term project of the U.S. internationally as well as with NATO.
So when Russia finally stepped in February of 2022 after increased escalation of bombings and military buildup by the Kiev forces outside the eastern Russian-speaking oblast, Russia was asked by those populations and did want to protect them, their culture, their population, their religion, and their language. Russian language is still prohibited today in Ukraine when it's in fact the majority language. So the point is that Russia was drawn in, and this was a success in the point of view of our war planners. They wanted war with Russia, and this was an escalation that they aimed for, they planned and provoked, and that's where we've been since 2014.
Earlier, I quoted Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who called Moscow's refusal to end its senseless war. Well, none of the media, I saw one oblique reference one, maybe on PBS NewsHour, to the peace conference at Istanbul in March, April of 2022, just a month after Russia went in, and the whole thing could have been stopped then. Everything could have gone back to the way it was before Russia went in. This would have been 3.5 years ago. Thousands and thousands of casualties later.
Millions.
Millions.
Could have been settled.
It was settled. It was initialed. And then Boris Johnson, then Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, was sent to Kiev to tell Zelensky, no, 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 no.
Yeah, Boris is still at his tricks. But all this is a historical record. The New York Times even later published the entire text of the Istanbul agreements. Once again, the point of this is there was a settlement, there was an agreement that would have ended the loss, stopped the loss of millions of injuries and death and loss of loss of territory and the destruction of Ukraine as a nation that it was. It's now at about half or less the population that it was 20 years ago.
A lot of them have gone to Poland, other places.
And Russia.
And Russia. And that's right from the eastern part of it, where they have quite prone to identify with Russia, the language and ties and all that. But it's also having a bigger effect. CHS, a local cooperative here in Minnesota, has just announced it's going to be pulling out of its warehouse, if I have it all right, in Odessa. And they're a large grain purveyor around the world, sunflower seeds, et cetera. And the Ukraine was, as Ukraine and Russia have been two of the very extensive growers of vast amounts of grain, often taken around the world for less developed countries, and that, but CHS says they're pulling out, and the damage to the growth of being able to grow more crops is, I'm sure some of it's still going on in Western, the Ukraine, but there's still a lot of problems there. Dave, you talked about times that U.S. corporations especially have been moving in there.
BlackRock, biggest landowner in what's left of Ukraine, and their European president conveniently became the Chancellor of Germany. Any conflict of interest possibility there as Germany, through Merz, a real warmonger, advocates for continuation of the war? Now, the crops we're talking about are like barley, wheat, sunflowers, and sunflower oil. Also, nitrogen and fertilizer are extremely important products, both on Russia and Ukraine. And, this is the kind of thing that's being lost.
And the whole way of the trying to keep the nuclear power Zaporizhia, where the fighting has been to keep the cooling systems going of this now shuttered nuclear power plant, but it still has a lot of needs for storage, and so it's a lot of things that need to be kept in place in order to keep the environmental aspect in the Ukraine.
Don referred a few minutes ago to war on Russia, which could be dated reasonably to 2014 in this case, but there's an important historical aspect in which I would say, without exaggeration, we've been at war with Russia for over 100 years, dating to the Bolshevik Revolution. And Britain's been at war with Russia for 200 years, and the Black Sea is the site of the confrontation, just as it was in the 1850s. Remember, wars are not just about territory, they're about resources and wealth, and what's playing out now with regard to these grains and other resources, critical minerals and so on, and the attacks on the Russian economy all illustrate that wars are fundamentally about resources and wealth and control of these.
So Britain, of course, had that in the 1850s, this battle in the Crimea, and it that's where the charge of the Light Brigade comes from. And so it's a long-term thing that Russia has been the object of the scrutiny or the opposition by England. Well, this has been the Northern Sun Radio News Show with
thanks, Don.
Dave Gutnick and myself, Don Olson. And we try and talk about some of these issues, which happen to be very crucial to world peace. Global Beat coming up next.
Welcome to MN90. Minnesota history in 90 seconds.
1923, George Leach wanted to be light. the World War I vet and insurance salesman, was running for a second term as Minneapolis's mayor. And likability, not to mention political skill and trustworthiness, helps at the ballot box. But that April 10th, a crew of concerned citizens set out to destroy that likability as they knocked door to door, handing out a publication that would only last two issues. This was the second issue, and it contained an article wholly unflattering to Leach. In it, a certain woman of the underworld claimed that the upstanding mayor liked to spend his free hours cavorting in a downtown room with her scantily clad employees. The publication in question was called The Voice of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, and it was the Klan who deeply disliked Leach for drumming their members out of the police force. George Leach, despite the smear campaign, was reelected and made sure certain select Klan members and the underworld businesswoman faced libel charges.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.